listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer and host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com, is on the line with us. Hey, Pap, how are you?
Tom, how are you today?
Great. So the Supreme Court is up to their weird old tricks and, you know, has been for some time. I mean, back to Bush v. Gore. I guess you could take this back to Buckley. This court has, I've never seen such a partisan court in my life.
Yeah, well, this is a court that's become really just an extension of regressive, punitive Republican policy. No other way to put it. They're intent on keeping minorities and students and the elderly and the disabled away from the polls, as we just see in this newest ruling in Ohio, which tells us a lot about this court. The ruling in Ohio is more than just the ruling in Ohio.
Let's revisit what that ruling was for some people know what we're talking about.
Yeah, what happened was that the court this week comes out and says that that Ohio, 16 hours before people are supposed to start voting, they say that we're not going to interfere with the state's attempt to try to keep people away from the polls, which is that it's a very restrictive law that was passed in Ohio, and an appellate court said, this is crazy, you can't do this. But this, and they issued an injunction. The Supreme Court says, oh, no, we're not going to let that injunction stand. So it's not just about Ohio. You know, there was no question in my mind or anyone following this court that this is how they were going to rule. And that's important because they've become almost comically predictable. The intent and political motivation of this court was made clear in this Ohio voting case. The dysfunctional, predictable majority has deprived thousands of Ohio residents the right to vote early. The court clearly understood that for many workers who want to vote, their only chance to cast a ballot is during this period that they call the Golden Week in Ohio, where voters can register and they can vote on the same day. And the court, you know what else they knew, Tom?
What's the court
knew that just last year, the Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted, admitted that voter suppression effort in Ohio was to keep minorities from voting. Came out of his mouth. And that is what the U.S. Supreme Court had in front of them. They knew it. They knew exactly what was going on here. But again, it's not just about Ohio. It's about this court in general. And that's the scary thing here. I was with a group of constitutional lawyers, probably the best in the country, recently. And what we saw to a person is they had this solid agreement that the Supreme Court majority has become this freakish character of what the highest courts in emerging third world countries typically look like. And I thought that was an interesting thing because there wasn't any dispute about it. Used to be, you know, the argument would be, oh, no, they're using stare decisis, they're using precedent. But one litmus test for judging the dysfunctionality of a final appeals court, Tom, is the quality of predictability that they show in their decisions. And we have that here. For example, a final appellate court in a third world country that's maybe situated in a setting where you have a corporate or a military-dominated control, well, they're predictably going to rule against average citizens. They're going to rule in favor of the industrialists who represent the money behind that government. They're going to predictably rule against environmental protections in favor of lawless polluters. And interestingly enough, and this is what I think is very interesting, if you take a look at these real dysfunctional courts, they'll take away and take away and take away, and then at the same time, every now and then, they'll throw out a few bones of appeasement on issues that might be gender rights issues, it might be reproductive health issues, but that's what we have here. We have a banana republic Supreme Court majority, Tom. There's no other way to put it.
It would be interesting to do an analysis. You know, in the UK, the Supreme Court does not have the power of judicial review or judicial supremacy. In the Netherlands, the UK doesn't have a constitution. Holland does have a constitution, and their constitution specifically prohibits their Supreme Court from having judicial review or judicial superiority, supremacy, excuse me. Mm-hmm. In many European countries, in many developed countries, the Supreme Court cannot knock down laws. The Supreme Court cannot interfere in things like elections like Bush v. Gore. It'd be fascinating to find out how frequently that's the case in third world countries. It might be worse than third world countries.
Well, the interesting thing is we're not in the dark about what Supreme Court majorities in third world countries looks like. So, I mean, I'm very comfortable telling you that this is a majority on the Supreme Court that's morphed the court into almost a clear blueprint of this, of a vast majority of third world courts. I mean, we have the history books. We have, it's in black and white. They're ultimate, the ultimate appellate courts in places like that, such as South America, Africa, Middle East, Asia. That's what we've become. In fact, the chief judge, if you'll remember, of that court, Roberts, of our U.S. Supreme Court, not South Africa, which is a surprise, but just 2 weeks ago, he was pondering the question about why the public image of the Supreme Court is suffering so, as if the answer is not right in front of his nose. But I don't know if you saw the article. It was almost comical. He's wondering, well, why don't they like us? Why don't they trust us? Any time a room, Tom, full of constitutional lawyers can predict what a court majority is going to rule within 100% accuracy, that alone is a symptom of failure. And everybody in the room that I was with, they could make these predictions. They could predict that there'll be continuing narrowing of voter access over time. With 100% 100% accuracy, they could continue to expand the personhood of corporations. You know this court's going to do that 100% of the time. They'll continue to expand the rights of corporations to commit fraud against consumers, to escape criminal sentencing when they have committed those crimes. 100% of the time we're going to see that from this court. And they're going to narrow the rights of consumers' access to the court, to expand arbitration and replace court access with these things called arbitrative kind of relief. Right. And so I think it tells us an important story when it's not an issue of stare decisis. It's not an issue of precedent. We know that they're simply political vehicles. I call them Republican thugs looking out for other Republican thugs. That's what this court majority has become. And, you know, at times I get letters and they say, how dare you say that about the Supreme Court? Well, it's the truth. I'm a lawyer that I practice with issues that this court has to look at all the time. And every time I read one of their opinion and it's written by a majority, I know what they're going to do. There's no guesswork because they're simply politicians in black robes. So all I have to know is what's the political policy of the Republican Party.
Right. And they essentially become an arm of the Republican Party. And the Republican Party has become an arm of the billionaires in corporate America. And it's just, I mean, Financial Times article today, business puts its cash behind Republicans. It just lays it right out. You know, they're trying to get a Republican majority in the Senate. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce just committed $30 million to this. It's amazing. And then you look at the Republican obstruction in the United States, at the damage that it's done to this country.
Oh, God. It's endless. I did an interview this week. As a matter of fact, I think it's gonna show this weekend on Free Speech TV. And the issue of obstructionism, if you just go down the list and we say, what have the, by the way, this obstruction has been enabled by the very Supreme Court we're talking about in a lot of ways. You've got Republicans who filibustered Obama's infrastructure bill. Okay. What did that do to our economy? Cost us billions in jobs. Republicans that they cut the path. They stood in the path of new highways and new bridges for infrastructure. They got in the way of closing the path on ending offshoring of jobs. That was something that was proposed. It was killed by them. All along the way, you see that obstruction by the Republican majority is taking place every day, but it's enabled by a court they know they can count on to support their obstruction.
Mike Papatonio, America's attorney, America's lawyer, ringoffireradio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Be sure to check out RingOfFireRadio.com. Paps, they're both on the weekend on the radio and on television as well on Free Speech TV. And welcome back. And Pap, how's the weekend show, Ring of Fire TV for Free Speech TV, shaping up?
Well, it's shaping up in a way that we always try to make it our brand, and that is to talk about issues that you will not find anywhere else, the same thing that you do. What's happened with the media right now, and it's really sad, but what's happened with the media is there are no backstories to the headlines. We don't even understand what a headline means anymore. We read a headline about ISIS. We don't have, they never connect the dots about what is ISIS? Where did it come from? We read a headline about maybe climate change, but there's no explanation about what's the story behind there. So what we try to do on Free Speech TV, as you do, the reason the value of Free Speech TV, the reason it's so critical, is I defy anybody watching the show to find the stories that you talk about and that we talk about and that Amy Goodman talks about on anywhere. Go looking for them. You can't find them because corporate media has become such a tool of corporate America. So the stories we're going to talk about, like this week, we're going to have Chauncey DeVega is going to talk about the latest police shootings. What's happening with police recruiting? How are they finding these bonehead police officers so consistently? Why is that happening? We're going to talk to David Hirsch about the consequences of obstructionism, as we just mentioned. What does it really cost? What are the details of that obstructionism? Howard Nation is going to talk about the right-wing assault on public education and how media, corporate media, furthers that assault on education. I'm going to have my law partner, and I don't overstate this a bit. Legend, I call him legendary trial lawyer. He is a spectacular trial lawyer who's changed the entire face of major social issues in this country. His entire career. He's 77 now, and he's written a book that is a fabulous book about his life and about how the issues that have come up the in his life. About how important it was in his mind to change big things like stopping smoking in this country as much as we can, about civil rights issues. This is a guy that was hand in hand on civil rights efforts in America. And it's great to, so I'm going to be interviewing him and talking about what does it mean to be an attorney? What's your responsibility to be an attorney beyond simply saying, well, this is a business. He looks at it like a business, but he understands what he does in his business has a huge, huge impact on social issues throughout this entire country.
Yeah.
So I've got a good show lined up. I hope people will tune in.
Yeah, and not only has Mr. Levin had that consequential life, you know, and many trial lawyers do, you yourself as well, but there is a concerted effort by Republicans and business groups all over this country with these so-called tort reform laws to basically render you guys impotent, to knock you out at the knees.
Tom, there's been efforts by the right wing, totally by the right wing, to have my partner, Fred Levin, arrested for murder twice, which were...
What?
They're fantasy stories, where they've had him turned into the Florida Bar Association no less than five times for things that if I told you, you would listen to these stories and say, well, what do you mean you were put before the Florida Bar for that?
Amazing.
Corporate America is in control of a lot of things, and he's going to talk about that in that interview.
That's great. Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire TV, right here on Free Speech TV, noon Eastern time on Sundays, and then it plays throughout the week on the periodically on the network. You can check it out at ringoffireradio.com. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
So much stuff in the news, it's just mind-boggling. I mean, the Ebola thing is rolling along, and of course it's capturing 24/7 wall-to-wall cable TV coverage and whatnot. It's, hey, if it bleeds, it leads, and Ebola really makes people bleed. The question, though, that I have yet to see, and I've watched more than I would like, I can't say that I've watched all of it, or anything even close to all of it, but, you know, of the various, particularly the big cable networks, CNN, MSNBC, and Fox, I have yet to see, and I kept raising this yesterday, I have yet to see anybody in the news media asking why it is that Dallas, Texas now has one, probably two cases of Ebola, and as many as 30 or 40, maybe more people exposed to Ebola. And in the face of this public health, let's call it a crisis or danger. I don't think it's an emergency yet, but it's serious stuff. In the face of this, Rick Perry has not simply said to the Republicans in the Texas legislature and to the federal government, okay, fine, we will take those billions in Obamacare dollars that Texas taxpayers paid in taxes, went to the federal government. The federal government is trying to give back to the state of Texas so that they can insure a quarter of the state. A quarter of the people in Texas have no health insurance whatsoever, and they're working. See, Texas does have Medicaid. Every state does. When Medicaid was rolled out in the 1960s, it was voluntary, just like the Obamacare Medicaid expansion is. And it took 4 or 5 years for every state to finally get to it, because there were a bunch of Republican-controlled states that said, oh, we're not going to do that. That's socialism. But eventually they all got on board. So if a person is genuinely poor and not working in Texas, they're already covered by Texas Medicaid. But if they're working at the crap jobs that Texas is leading the nation in creating. Texas leads the nation in creating minimum wage and low-paying jobs. If they are working at these jobs that pay $7, $8, $9 an hour, $10 an hour in the best of universes in Texas, they make so little that they don't qualify for the Obamacare subsidies, but they make enough that they no longer qualify for the free Medicaid through the state of Texas. This is called the Red State Donut Hole. And it was created by the U.S. Supreme Court. John Roberts and four other right-wing crazies on the Supreme Court created this loophole. And all the Republicans in Texas have to do is say, yeah, no problem. Give us the money. We'll insure everybody. We'll cover everybody. Because we've got a public health emergency on our hands, or at least a public health what could be a public health emergency. And we want everyone, if somebody gets a fever in that apartment building where the Ebola guy was living, handling the same doorknobs he was on the way in and out. Apparently Ebola can live, unlike AIDS. Ebola, you know, AIDS, you get bodily fluids from AIDS victims on any surface that's exposed to oxygen, and boom, the virus is dead. But Ebola, not so much. It looks like it can live 2 or 3 days outside the body. And this fellow who finally, on his second try to get into the hospital, he was outside puking on the lawn of the building, barfing on the lawn, as the ambulance was coming to get him. So this is an issue where you really don't want people to not go to the doctor because they can't afford it. In other words, this is a situation where when somebody says, you know, I kind of feel like crap, and I got a fever, and my muscles are aching, and I'm living in the same building with a guy who had Ebola, but, you know, I only make $8 an hour or $9 an hour working at McDonald's or Walmart or Burger King or, you know, fill in the blank, right? I only make $9 an hour, so I make too much to qualify for free Medicaid in the state of Texas, but not enough to get Obamacare. So, you know, if I go to the doctor, it's going to cost me $50. $50 is, you know, 2 days' pay after taxes and everything else, and maybe a day's pay, whatever it is. Plus, I got to lose pay because Texas has no paid sick policy. So there's no requirement that employers give people paid days off when they're genuinely sick. These two insanely stupid Republican policies, keeping a quarter of the state uninsured and allowing employers to essentially force people to come to work sick, are as insane as it gets. Why have none of the national media, why have none of these reporters, none of these stenographers, none of these commentators, why have none of them looked into the camera and said, why isn't Rick Perry expanding Medicaid right now to deal with a public health crisis in Texas? Why isn't the Texas legislature talking about paid sick days to deal with a public health crisis in Texas? Why are they not asking this question? Is it like everybody's trying to protect Rick Perry?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, think of this. This is really simple, straightforward stuff. This isn't rocket science. We'll be right back. Just some of the other amazing stories that we're looking at. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Arkansas is one of 20 states where it is between hard and impossible for the state to offer the low-cost, high-speed internet access that they are already bringing into public universities. You'll recall, DARPANET started out as a, you know, as the defense internet, basically. You know, the internet was invented for the Department of Defense, and then it went to universities. This is back in the 70s and very early 80s. And every university in the country was connected through the internet, and then we got CompuServe, and then you got AOL. And then, in fact, I remember going, I used to run forums for CompuServe. Nigel and Sue and I ran a whole bunch of forums all over CompuServe. And I remember sitting in this meeting in Columbus, Ohio, in, it must have been like 85, maybe 86, something like that. It was in the mid-80s. And we were running these, we were running a whole bunch of forums on CompuServe, the Mac user forum, the PC user forum, the ADD forum, the JFK assassination forum, the ADHD forum. On and on. And we had the UFO forum. We had the International Trade Forum. And I'm sitting there, and they're doing this presentation of this is this new thing called hypertext markup language, HTML. Because the only way you could get on the internet back then, unless you were a real techie, was through CompuServe. And then AOL had come along. But in any case, they said, this is HTML, and this is going to revolutionize the internet. And they showed how you could click on hyperlinks and move from page to page. And about half the audience was like, half the people in the room, you know, we all ran forums for CompuServe. We were like, well, that's interesting, but it's not going to go anywhere. And the other half of us were going, excuse me, we're going, whoa, this is serious stuff. So anyhow, this started out, every university basically in the country is wired together on, you know, high-speed, low-cost internet. And it could be easily extended to the public schools in all these states. But in 20 states, the telecom companies have gotten rules or laws passed to make that impossible, difficult, or even illegal so that they can price gouge internet service to the local public schools. This is, you know, welcome to Paul Ryan's America, right? Oh, speaking of Paul Ryan, he has a book out from Hachette, which Amazon hates with a passion. I have a book from Hachette as well. It's called Threshold. And Amazon has been playing hardball with Hachette. Hachette is the largest publisher in the world. They're based out of France. But Leslie Savin, writing over at The Nation, points out that there's a difference between two books, right? Sons of Wichita, which exposes the Koch brothers, kind of hard to get on Amazon because it's a Hachette book. On the other hand, The Way Forward by Congressman Paul Ryan, easy to get on Amazon, even though it's a Hachette book. People scratching their head on that one. I think this is, you know, we'll see where this goes. Ebola is infecting 5 new people every hour in Sierra Leone, according to The Guardian. This is a really rapid spread. This is not good. Business, this from the Financial Times, the headline by Barney Jobson in Washington, D.C., business puts its cash behind Republicans. U.S. business groups are investing record sums to help the Republican Party seize control of Congress. He writes, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the political arm of traditional business, has spent $30 million on the elections and is on track to beat its previous expenditure record. Scott Reed, the chamber's top political strategist, told the Financial Times that their goal was to oust Democrats and install a pro-business Republican majority in the Senate. Right. All across the country, people are organizing cop watch groups. They listen to scanners. This is, you know, let me just remind you. Back in the 60s, California was an open carry state. You could carry a gun on your hip in California in the 60s. Ronald Reagan was governor. Huey Newton and a bunch of his buddies, because so many black people were being beat up and shot and arrested inappropriately, and the stuff that's going on right now, right? Only it was arguably even worse back then. A lot less consciousness about it. Huey Newton said, we're going to show up. You know, they got a bunch of police scanners. And whenever the police were called to a quote, crime scene that involved people of color, Huey Newton and a half a dozen guys would show up in a car, and they would be carrying long rifles. And I mean, they'd literally get out of the car with hunting rifles and guns on their hips. And then they went to the state legislature that way, carrying guns into Sacramento. And Ronald Reagan and the white power structure of California freaked out and ended open carry in California because some black guys were showing up with guns. Now, all over the country, white people are still showing up with guns, and it's fine with us, right? But that was, so that was the end of that. I'm just wondering, these cop watch groups, this is not even showing up with guns. This is showing up with cameras. But police departments across the country are starting to track these groups, these people. They're busting them. They're harassing them. Bad stuff. And breaking news, the Supreme Court has been asked to block the Wisconsin voter suppression laws. We'll see where that goes. Anyhow, there's a bunch of other stuff that I wanted to share with you. In fact, I've got this whole long rant about digital medical records, but we'll get into it later on in the program. Let me get some of our callers in here. Marsha in Conroe, Texas. You wanted to talk about healthcare in Texas?
Yes, thank you, Tom. That's one of Wendy Davis's biggest issues.
Really? That's great.
Yes. She just did a debate with Abbott this week, and it was great. The sad part was it wasn't on every channel. It was on PBS. You had to be there at 8. But I encourage anybody from Texas to Google that and watch the entire thing because it's...
I understand she sort of handed him his head.
She did.
Yeah.
She did. She's pumped me up. If I'm standing in line next to somebody, I'm asking them who they're voting for and why.
There you go.
I am just hitting the streets. I asked my beautician while she was doing my hair who she voting for, and she started coming up with presidential things.
Oops.
I got home, and I realized she does not know that there's an election this year.
Right.
And at the same time, she was complaining about what Rick Perry had done with the health care. And because of Rick Perry, her mentally ill nephew is falling between the cracks.
Right. He's falling into the red state donut hole.
Spending time in jail for it.
Oh, jeez.
And having trouble getting him out. This is such a huge issue. So if your listeners are from Texas, get out there. Talk to people. If somebody's standing in line next to you, ask them, because
yeah.
I got her on board, and she's more than willing to jump up and go elect the person she wants for governor.
Great. Good on you, Marsha. Thank you for the call. Thanks for the heads up, and thanks for the great story. Ryan in Belton, Texas. Hey, Ryan.
Hi, Tom. And I just want to say kudos to Marsha. I know a lot of people down here in Bell County that are getting quite sick and, the exact same thing she's saying. I wanted to speak about the healthcare, too. I've got too many friends. I, myself, I've been out of college now for 4 years. The 6 months that I've had health insurance in those 4 years were the 6 months that I was working for Organizing for America in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Wow.
And, you can work a job, you can do whatever you need to here in Texas, but it's a beautiful state, and there's nothing wrong except whenever you start getting down here, thank God the guy didn't go into a restaurant, because there's no waiter that I know that doesn't have to work at least try and get 60 hours, but then they can't really work 60 hours because you can't get overtime, but has to work 60 hours a week so that they can get enough of the corporate requirements so that they can wait, so that they can get health insurance just for waiting tables and getting paid $213 an hour to boot.
So,
I'm right there with her. We've got to get out and vote. Wendy Davis, people have got to start talking about her here in Texas, and that's just what I wanted to say. I'm sorry I went on for so long.
No, that's great. You did a great job, Ryan, and I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Donald in Chicago. Hey, Donald. Texas?
Yes. How you doing there, Tom?
Good.
The thing that gets me about these Republican states, all they got to do is look at Detroit, and that's where they're going to be headed. I, in a way, I can't feel sorry for any of them, and that includes Texas, because These people, I mean, for the, I never see them screaming. None of them. They should be outraged. All these Republican states, you never hear the people screaming whether it comes to wages or health care or if anything else. But the only problem is they put these clowns in power, and they start walking up the steps of the gallows, and we're all going to pay that price now.
Yeah.
And it all, a lot of it has to do with the fact that most of them are racist, and that's what the problem is with this crap. I am so aggravated with it.
Well, I would say that at the level of the electorate, there's a lot of racism. I think at the level of the guys who are sitting around doing the planning for the Republicans, there may or may obviously there's racism, but the thing is that they're using that to manipulate average working people. But it's really about the money. For example, this from the Financial Times, the headline says it all. The Tories are the conservatives in the UK, you know, David Cameron. High earners will gain most from Tory plans as spending cuts go deep. And the first sentence, this is Vanessa Holder and Chris Giles writing for the Financial Times. High earners will benefit the most from David Cameron's proposals for a $7.2 billion income tax cut. Plans that will compound the challenge the UK government faces in balancing the books. And, you know, it's just... it's conservatives all around the world. They're there to represent the interests of the well-born and the well-bred, the well-connected, the wealthy. Donald, thank you for your call. And not the interests of working people. They don't give a damn about the interests of working people. In fact, if anything, they want to keep working people quiet and frightened. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's pretty amazing. In the UK, David Cameron's actually running on the platform of I'm going to lower taxes on rich people. Yeah. Welcome back. Kenyatta in Redlands, California, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Kenyatta, yesterday while we were talking, you were saying, Tom, I can't hear you. And I was talking to you, but apparently one of our phones crashed. My apologies.
No worries, Tom. I really appreciate it. I don't want to use up, I know you've got lots of callers, and I'm really honored to talk to you. I think you're one of the smartest people in this country, and I really admire your courage. I said that yesterday. You were modest, but I'm going to run through a couple of things real quick because I want to
go for
be fair with time, especially given that I've about used my quota up. You know, I'm a big fan of the Greek philosophers, Tom, and Plato said that the beginning of wisdom is a definition of terms. And, you know, I think that one of the reasons that nothing ever gets done in this country is because we never sit back. You know, Mike Papantonio, who's a brilliant guy you had on your show earlier, talked about backstories. And we never know the backstories. We never think about the words that we use. For instance, the word terror. I have asked in my blog for years for someone to define the word terrorist to me and how the United States does not fit that definition. And I've been bombarded with death threats and all kinds of other things, but I still haven't gotten an answer. Yeah. I worked in law enforcement, Tom. The word police is a derivative of the word policy. Mike Papantonio talked about these police shootings. Mm-hmm. You talked about the Black Panthers earlier and the open carry here in California.
Right.
Black people, black men in particular, have been assassinated by the police forever. It's the policy. It's the policy. And this, you know, every time it happens, you know, this fake outrage just blows my mind. Because if you think about it, and again, let's get back to policy. JFK, RFK, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King were all killed, I think, within 60 months of one another. Mm-hmm. All of them, you know, forget ideologies. All of them were about the suffrage of black people and civil rights.
Yep.
What was the message there? And I think that's why so many black people and black men in particular are frankly afraid to speak out. This tendency to you know, from lynchings and castrations, this is part of the policy. And I want to say one more thing, Tom. Yesterday, I was watching Fox. I hate to, it's hard to stomach sometimes, but I like to know what those folks are thinking.
Sure.
And, you know, intermittently, I looked at the broadcast, and the entire day was this dog whistle, and not so silent, of villainizing black people. The guy who did the beheading in Oklahoma, right. Ebola,
Abu Jamal. It was the whole. It was incredible.
Yeah.
It was absolutely.
Oh, and whenever a crime is committed by a black person, they get the scariest picture they can and throw it on the screen. And if crimes are committed by white people, they may or may not show pictures.
I got to tell you this real quick. I was listening to a conservative local talk show host this morning on the radio, and they've coined a term called Obamola.
What's that?
Ebola, Obama.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, carrying on the fine tradition of Michael Savage. Kenyatta, great to hear from you. Thank you for the call, and I'm glad we got through this time. Apologies again for yesterday. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Stick around. Slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. Joe in Chicago Heights, Illinois. Hey, Joe, what's up? Joe?
For sure.
Okay. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hello, Tom. Yeah, this is a perfect example of the have and have nots. I had a gentleman who went to the hospital. He went to emergency.
Right.
Because he didn't have no insurance. They did what emergencies are told to do, stabilize him and send him home.
Right.
If he had health insurance, they would have took him in, did some tests, and probably found out what he had and then quarantined him. So because you're so intent on keeping poor people poor that you would endanger you and your family by keeping the have-nots down with low wages and no benefits. And there you go. Now you got an epidemic here.
Yeah, this is, you know, a libertarian paradise, right? I mean, Liberia has basically no national health care system. They have a virtually no national public education system. By the way, did you see where Germany just dropped all college tuition, period? College tuition no longer exists in the country of Germany. I mean, it no longer exists. All colleges are free. We have student debt.
We can have that, too, if we put a transaction tax.
Yeah, but see, it's like, here's the difference. You know, like Liberia has become a libertarian paradise. It's exactly what Rand Paul wants, you know. The government basically runs the police and the military, and that's it. And they, you know, they'll lock down a slum or something if they think that there might be Ebola, which wasn't, it turns out, so bright. But they can't do anything else because it's a libertarian paradise. And, you know, this is what Greg Abbott wants for Texas, it appears. Corky, excellent call. Thank you very much. Jill in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Jill, you want to talk about Supreme Court?
Hi, yeah. Apparently the ACLU is challenging my state's new voter ID law that is taking effect now for this election.
Yeah,
and
let's call it a voter suppression law because that's what it is.
It is a voter suppression law, and I work for the Burke campaign, and I work for, trying to get people out to vote. And people are being put out, and not just low income. It's the elderly. My mother had to go through a lot just to get the correct ID. She's 78 years old. She still has all her faculties, you know. And the thing I'm getting from my Republican people, friends around here, is that they don't even want people that don't already have these IDs or a driver's license. They think they shouldn't be voting anyway.
Right.
What do you think about that? They, you know, because they think they're not that they're not a person enough.
Yeah, well, George Will danced around this, a few months ago in one of his op-eds. This is a not so secret commentary on the right that goes back literally to the founding of the republic, where there were during the Constitutional Convention a number of people who proposed that only property owners should be allowed to vote because their wealth demonstrated their moral uprightness, and that we couldn't have debtors voting, we couldn't have poor people voting. That would be a bad thing. And, you know, that strain of thinking still very much exists in the conservative movement, in the conservative mind. And it animates much of these voter suppression efforts. They think they're doing it for the most noble of reasons. We got to keep the rabble from voting because they will try to, you know, raise taxes on rich people and take our money and make America a more equal society and stuff like that. I mean, we just can't have that. Jill, excellent point. Thank you for calling and making it. Keith in Landrum, South Carolina. Hey, Keith, you wanted to get back to Texas?
Hey, Tom.
I tried your argument last night on Facebook concerning Texas and that one-fourth is uninsured.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our Republican friends came back and said, oh, that 25% that's uninsured, they're all illegals.
No, they're not.
I know that. I did a Google search, and it's only 7%. But this is the prejudice that we're running up against.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's not even 7% of the state who are uninsured, who are not with, you know, who are undocumented. It may be 7% of the 25%, but it's a relatively small number. The point, you know, this is the, and by the way, when people say, oh, they're illegals, this is code for, oh, by the way, have you noticed they have brown skin? So, by and large, you're not going to make much progress when you're trying to talk to people who are completely brainwashed by billionaires like the Koch brothers into believing that it's in the interests of working people to screw working people. It's in the interests of working people for people not to have health insurance. This is something the Koch brothers are selling really, really hard, especially on college campuses now. And if somebody's stupid enough to buy it, then probably you're not going to be able to have a rational conversation with them. Keith, thanks for the call. Good luck. Keep it up. Hack in Oklahoma City. Hey, Hack, what's up?
Speaking of brainwashed people, I talked to just such a brainwashed person in a bar in Wyoming last night.
Mm-hmm.
But anywho, the question is, are we the home of the free? Are we the land of the free and home of the brave, or are we the land of the greed and the home of the scared?
Yeah, I think the conservatives want to make us the latter. Clearly, you know, be afraid, and
well, beyond a doubt.
Yeah, and apropos of the land of the free, I think that, you know, FDR's comment that a necessitous man is not a free man. If you're jobless, you're not free. If you're homeless, you're not free. If you're without food, you're not free. And if you have no health care, you're not free. You are a slave to these basic, slave is too strong a word, but you are in servitude to these basic needs. And the conservatives like that very much. You know, hey,
yeah.
You know, these people are scared to death.
I'm pretty much to the point now, Tom, where I've written off these people as chickens voting for Colonel Sanders.
Yeah, chickens voting for Colonel Sanders. I love it. That is great. And you're so right, Hack. I mean, this is really what it is. You know, Thomas Frank, you know, wrote that book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And, you know, it's like everybody, Hack, thanks a lot for the call. Everybody's trying to figure out, you know, what's the deal? Why do people vote against their own self-interest? And they do because you've got a multi-million dollar machine making it happen. I mean, this morning I'm listening to NPR, and there's a thing about how Harry Reid has something to do with a PAC that's spending more money than the Koch brothers, which is not true. But NPR, everybody thinks, you know, this is the real story. It's amazing. These guys are relentless. They're editing Wikipedia all like crazy. They are funding media all across the United States. They just never give up. They keep banging away, and they've got the money to do it. It's amazing.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Here is the story that everybody should be talking about today. I mean, really, every American needs to know this. Germany just banned college tuition. Now, prior to 2006, I lived in Germany 86, 87, and there was no college tuition then. College was free. In 2006, and I believe that was the election that brought Merkel in. I could be wrong. But, you know, Merkel is a conservative. She's sort of a Bob Dole conservative, but she's a conservative, the Christian Democratic Party. And in 2006, Germany actually allowed tuition. They allowed colleges to start charging. I mean, it was only the maximum tuition in the country is about $4,500 a year, but they allowed it. And now, I think it was Lower Saxony, now the last of the German states to allow college tuition, colleges to charge tuition, has banned the practice. So in Germany, because they have a national healthcare system, you cannot go broke because you get sick. It doesn't happen in the country. And you cannot go broke or graduate from college broke because you went to college. This has to do with the commons. Let me take this a step beyond just college, because there's all these areas that have to do with the commons where conservatives have been hell-bent for leather to bore holes into our commons to create opportunities for profit. When the things that have to do with our commons are better done by government. This is why government is created. Ronald Reagan wouldn't want you to know this. You're not going to hear this on right-wing talk radio. Now, you will understand this if you take any government class or any history class. But the purpose of government is to administer the commons for the public benefit, for the public good, for the general welfare, as our Constitution says, in two or three different places. So here now we have this article in the New York Times, Doctors Find Barriers to Sharing Digital Medical Records. You and I, with our tax dollars, have given $24 billion. $24 billion to hospitals, doctors' offices, and by pass-through, virtually all of it went to companies, for-profit corporations, the largest of which is discussed at some length in this article in the New York Times, Doctors Find Barriers to Sharing Digital Medical Records by Julie Cresswell. It's called Epic. It was founded by Judith Faulkner, who is now worth over $2 billion. So you can make serious money when you are doing the business of the commons for profit. But here's the problem. As Julie Cresswell writes in today's New York Times, almost 18 months after the Epic system was installed at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Sioux City, Iowa, physicians there still cannot transmit a patient care document to doctors 2 miles south at Mercy Medical Center, which uses a system made by another major player in the field, the Cerner Corporation. They also note, separately, through its maintenance contracts and other agreements, Epic charges a fee to send data to non-Epic systems. And the woman who started this company is worth $2.3 billion, according to the New York Times, which raises the question. And she makes the point, Ms. Faulkner, the woman who started the company, she makes the point the government didn't establish any standards for electronic medical records. They mandated them, but they didn't establish any standards. So we did. And our standards at Epic, in this the case of this company, are thus and so, right? These are our standards. And it's secure, and it works well, and if you're within the Epic system, you can talk to each other. But if you're outside the Epic system, we're going to charge you extra to transmit your data, to modify, convert it, make it compatible, or you just can't do it. Now, this, you know, she is absolutely right in saying the government didn't establish standards. And it's this is this post-Reagan belief that somehow standards or regulation are evil or bad.
and somehow the marketplace is going to solve the problem. Well, eventually the marketplace will solve this problem. There'll be one company left standing. And now that the Defense Department is about to put out an $11 billion contract for digitizing medical records to a private firm, and in all probability it'll go to Epic, which is, again, I'm not trashing this company. My point is that if our federal government had said, here's the standards. You have to have this level of security. You have to have this level of intercommunication ability, whatever the word is, communicability, communication with other systems. Or if we had just done it ourselves. You know, if the federal government had simply established this and said, you know, it's here's a system. It's like Social Security. Social Security has never failed to pay a check. The IRS is actually quite efficient at collecting taxes. The Department of Defense, you can complain all day long, and I will not stop you about, you know, 700 military bases and spending more than every other country in the world on defense. But the fact of the matter is that the Department of Defense knows how to get things done. Government can work. Government does work. Our public schools are now demonstrably better than our private schools, our charter schools. There is a time and place in the commons for government. Why do we have a brand new billionaire? Why do we have a woman who's worth $2 billion because she's doing something that we should be doing? We the people should be doing, our government should be doing. Or at least the government should be establishing standards so that, see, in the lack of standards, what you end up with is whatever company owns the biggest platform ends up owning the marketplace because they're building walls around their system, which all of these companies are trying to do. They're all trying to say, we have this proprietary system. You have to use our system if you want to have, you know, electronic medical records. And sometimes they scan documents. Sometimes they digitize documents. Sometimes they manually enter the information. You know, and it's a mess. It's an absolute mess. Right now, something like 14% of doctor's offices can actually communicate this stuff. I mean, this is bizarre. And what it does is it creates essentially monopolies. We see the same thing with our voting machines. You know, if we're going to use technology for voting, and we started out back in the 50s or 60s with these mechanical voting machines. And you could literally walk around the back of the machine and see the gears turning and see the counters incrementing. I did as a little kid. My mom was check people off the list and said, here, go vote. So if we're going to have machines, let's have transparent machines and let's have government-owned machines. But no, we've got to privatize this. And then with the Help America Vote Act, George W. Bush, 2002, we've got to give billions of dollars to these for-profit corporations, Diebold, ES&S, et cetera, via the states, federal money just channeled through so that the beating heart of democracy is in the hands of private for-profit corporations. Our health systems are in the hands of private for-profit corporations. Our prisons increasingly are in the hands of private for-profit corporations. This is the libertarian paradise that the Koch brothers and the right-wingers and the Republican Party have promised us. And it doesn't work.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day. Oh, the trade policy with Europe. This is falling apart, too. I'm getting back. And your calls. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And set this over here. By the way, Free Speech TV is in their fundraising drive right now. Please call them now, 877-378-8669, and make a contribution. And if you are If you're not watching us on Free Speech TV, if you're listening to us right now on one of our Pacifica-affiliated radio stations, many of them are in fundraising drives right now, too. So listen for their phone number and give them a call and participate, because we need nonprofit media in this country. We really do. Let's see here. Looking for Free Speech TV. Hey, Bruce in Clinton, Maine. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk to you. I'm trying to email, but I can't. But I wanted to talk to you about, like, Texas for, you know, the Medicaid. The amount you can earn as an individual and even qualify is $146 a month if you're a parent with a child that qualifies for CHIP, and zero as an adult. And if you go down the list from CMS, and I was trying to send it to you, the only one lower is Alabama, is $126 a month. Most of the states that have passed Medicaid expansion, it's $1,293, whether you're a parent or just an adult like me. I lost my Medicaid because of Paula Page, and, you know, I don't get it, but you have to be so poor in Texas to even qualify for Medicaid. I mean,
no, it's not just Texas. It's all over the country.
Or more dollars that you can earn a month. You know, that's way below poverty wages.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's not just in Texas. It's all over the country. And this is why Obamacare was going to expand Medicaid in these, you know, in the states. And you know, had John Roberts and the other four right-wing whack jobs on the U.S. Supreme Court not taken that bite out of Obamacare, right now we would have a national health care system that would be able to deal with, you know, a potential Ebola outbreak. But,
yeah,
you know, as it is.
I agree. And if you saw the webpage, I was trying to email it, but I couldn't figure out how. But I signed up for your account. But even for adults like me, I'm a single childless adult, and I've been disabled for 20 years. I lost everything. And it says other adults, 000, but it's almost always under a state that didn't expand Medicaid.
Right.
Some states, you know, Minnesota, I could earn $1,945 a month and still qualify for Medicaid.
In Minnesota.
That's not even the expansion under Obama. That's just Medicaid.
Right. Well, that's because each state sets the threshold below which people qualify for Medicaid. And what you find is that the states that are run by Republicans have actually driven down those thresholds over time, or they have not adjusted them for inflation over time, which is the same effect. Whereas the states run by Democrats have tended to increase their Medicaid thresholds along with inflation over the last couple of decades. It's been, five decades?
I knew Texas was one of the worst, but it has 1,926 if you have a child. But if you look at the definition under the footnote, that has to be a child with a disability and all that. So that's not your income. That's the child getting money because, you know,
he
has some physical disability.
It's amazing stuff, Bruce. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Past the hour, Tom Harbin here with you. Welcome back. Dennis in Elmhurst, Illinois. Hey, Dennis, you wanted to talk about Germany?
Yeah. In this country, we have a progressive tax based on income. Does Germany have a progressive tax based on income?
Yes.
Or is it a flat tax?
No. It's a progressive tax that it's been a couple of years since I've looked at the numbers. The last time I did, I think the top tax rate was 56%.
And in this country, it's what, under 40?
Yeah, it's 36 and change, 36.9, I think.
All right.
And if you earn and in the United States, if you earn your money with money as opposed to by working for a living, in other words, a brain surgeon who makes $400,000 a year will pay 36% on the last $100,000 or so that they make. But Mitt Romney, you know, somebody who makes their money by investing, they pay a maximum 15 or 20%. I think the capital gains have now gone up to 20%, but they pay a maximum 20% income tax rather than that 36% income tax. And this here's a poignant story about this, because, you know, if some right winger says, oh, yeah, you know, it's Germany has free education, free health care, but, you know, my taxes are going to go explode. There was, first of all, the taxes of average working people don't explode. And secondly, they have quite high wages there. The average industrial wage in Germany is $54 an hour. So,
wow.
You know, even, yeah, and even if this is like what Volkswagen pays in Germany, right? And it's one of the reasons why they're building factories here in the United States for the U.S. market. But the point is that there was a year or so ago, I was maybe longer than that. I was watching. I'm pretty sure it was Bloomberg. They have a show that I used to be able to catch. In fact, it must have been when I lived in Portland, because it was, you know, we catch it on satellite TV, and it was over, you know, it was one of these kind of overnight shows out of Singapore. And and the interviewer was an American who was in Singapore, or maybe Hong Kong, one or the other. And he was interviewing a German businessman who was a very, very wealthy German businessman. And he said, the interviewers, and they were talking about, you know, the economy and just, you know, all this macroeconomic stuff. And at one point, the interviewer, this kid from America, this reporter from America, said, how much do you pay in income taxes, by the way? And the German businessman said, well, I think I pay around 55%, 56%, or whatever it was. You know, I don't remember the exact number, but it was in that neighborhood. It was steep. And on the high end of my income, I mean, you know, of course, the first couple $100,000, I pay much less on income taxes on that because it's a progressive system. And this reporter said, well, how can you deal with that? I mean, isn't that terrible? And the guy said, no, it's fine with me. You know, I have plenty of money. And they went on to another topic. And then the reporter came back to it and he said, I still don't get how you're not angry about all the income taxes you're paying. And the guy said, well, our country works. We look out for each other. And I have no problem paying these income taxes. I have a very good income. And so then they changed topics again. And then a third time, this reporter comes back and he says to this German businessman, he says, I still don't get it. Why are you not furious? Why? Where are all the other people like you who are multimillionaires, who earn millions of dollars a year, who are paying 56% in income taxes? Why are you not organizing a tax revolt in Germany? And the guy looked at him like, what kind of idiot are you? And he said, I do not want to be a rich man in a poor country.
Yeah.
And that just stopped the conversation.
My right-wing friends, every time I bring this up, you know, about Scandinavian countries and not going broke when you're sick.
Right.
Or getting an education and not coming out of college with, $200,000 in student loans.
Right.
They all say, well, yeah, but if the government handled all that and it was all free, our taxes would be ridiculous.
No, in all probability, the people you're talking to, their taxes would not be any different. I mean, we have a top 36% tax rate. I'm guessing that anybody you meet in a bar is not paying that. I mean, you've got to earn over $400,000 or over $300,000, whatever it is, to start bumping up against that tax rate.
So if we went with free college and let's say universal health care and it was all not for profit type stuff,
right?
Do you think our taxes would then be in that neighborhood, a progressive tax with a top end of about that 55%?
I think it would work, and in fact, if you look, you'll find the background and the research for this in a book I wrote called Rebooting the American Dream. But Larry Beinhart did some really, really great research on this. What he found is that whenever, and not just in the United States, all over the world, whenever the top tax rate on really rich people is over 50%, then you have a stable economy. The economy cools down. Not cools down like it gets bad, but, you know, you don't have bubbles and bursts. And whenever the top tax rate goes below 50%, then you get these 10 to 15 year cycles of boom, bust, boom, bust, boom, bust. And the reason why is quite simply explained. It's very easy to understand. It's that when people are paying 40, 50, 60% income tax on the, you know, they don't pay that on the first couple $100,000, but they start paying that on the, you know, or it used to be back, you know, before Reagan, it might be the first million, you don't pay that. But after that, you start paying this high income tax rate. At that point, they start treating their money like it's really precious. It was hard to get that money, and so they invested very carefully and very cautiously. You drop that income tax rate down to 28%, as Ronald Reagan did, and or even as low as 30%, as long as it's below 50%, 36%, what happens is that the money is easy to get, right? And so with all this hot money that was easily acquired, people will throw it into risky investments, and that's how you get bubbles. And so not only would raising the top tax rate not affect anybody you're going to meet in a bar, it's only going to affect the top one-tenth of 1%, but it also will stabilize the economy. And if we were to roll back the Reagan tax cut, we could easily pay for college education for everybody in this country, and we could pay for a national health care system. It's very, very simple. And with regard to Social Security, you want to stabilize our national pension system for the all time, you know, world without end, amen, simply lift the cap. Right now, anybody who makes over $130,000 or $118,000, whatever it is, it's in that neighborhood, anybody who makes more than that, after they've paid Social Security taxes on that first $118,000, their tax rate goes to zero. It's the opposite of a progressive tax rate. Instead of going up, it goes to zero. So if you simply made Social Security a flat tax, you know, the stuff that Steve Forbes talks about, then the Social Security program would not just be solvent forever, but it would be solvent with enough extra money that you could substantially raise Social Security benefits. Dennis, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Once again, this is not rocket science. Germany is doing this, they're, as most European countries do, and they are not going down in flames. They're doing very well, though. People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, the place where smart people get their news. Since 2009, since the Obama stimulus, I mean, President Obama, let's keep in mind, in 2009, the first couple of months of his being president, he did not have a filibuster-proof Senate. Because Al Franken and the guy that he ran against, Norm Coleman was his name, as I recall, Norm Coleman was contesting the election, and so they couldn't swear Al Franken in. And so there wasn't a filibuster-proof Senate. Eventually, Al Franken got sworn in, and there was a filibuster-proof Senate, and that lasted for 74 days until Massachusetts had a special election to replace Teddy Kennedy, and Scott Brown won that election, and then Obama lost his filibuster-proof Senate. So he had a filibuster-proof Senate for 74 days, maybe 72 days, one or the other. During that time, a lot got done. I mean, a lot got done in those 72 days. The biggest middle class tax cut in America history. Chrysler was saved. GM was saved. The loan was repaid. We went from 800,000 monthly job losses to monthly job gains. We increased spending on education. We cut the cost of student loans. We strengthened hate crime laws. We passed the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. The Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIPS, was expanded. The enforcement of child labor laws was expanded. The Wall Street reform was passed, Dodd-Frank. Credit card reform was passed. That was part of Dodd-Frank. Predatory lending to soldiers was restricted. Troops are paid for stop-loss time. We stopped officially doing torture. VA spending was increased. Women are allowed to serve on subs. Equal pay for women was passed as a law. Nuclear arms reduction and disposal. BP agreed to a $20 billion cleanup fund, although they're fighting that now in court. The EPA was strengthened. The FDA powers were broadened. The 9/11 responders' health care funding was passed. Over all of these over Republican objections. But since then, Republicans have been fighting to prevent anything from happening. Anything since 2009, since that 72 or 74 days that Obama had a filibuster-proof Senate. For example, in 2011, they filibustered Obama's infrastructure bill. In 2012, this is a great piece on this at ourfuture.org by Dave Johnson, Campaign for America's Future. The bipartisan transportation and housing bill was filibustered. The phantom filibuster blocking the path for the highway bill in 2012. Student loan reform was filibustered. Teachers and First Responders Back to Work Act was filibustered. Extended unemployment benefits was filibustered. Public Safety Employee Cooperation Act, which lets public safety officers, police officers join unions, it was filibustered. The Buffett rule, which ensures that millionaires pay the same tax rate as their secretaries, was filibustered. The bill to repeal big oil tax subsidies was filibustered. All of these things did incredible damage to our economy, or at least prevented our economy from being put back together.
So when you hear Republicans complain about the economy, they are bragging. They are bragging about their accomplishments of 6 years of obstruction, 6 years minus 74 days. And on top of that, here are some of the things that Speaker Boehner, that the Republicans in the House of Representatives, they control the House. They're, you know, they may end up controlling the Senate after this election if you and everybody you know doesn't get out and vote. They voted, you know, what, over 40 times to repeal Obamacare. They've eliminated overtime pay with the so-called Working Families Flexibility Act. They have passed legislation to make welfare programs, you know, preserving work requirements, even if you're disabled. I mean, it's approved the Keystone Pipeline. Now, none of this stuff passed the Senate, but this is the Republican agenda. More offshore drilling, promoting more charter schools, cutting federal programs in support for our educational system. The Energy Consumer Relief Act, which blocks regulation of oil companies. Right, that's really a consumer. The Stop Government Abuse Act. Right. The Keep the IRS Off Your Health Care. It's just, they're so good at naming these things. This goes on for like five pages. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but this is the kind of damage that is done to America when Republicans have political power. And you can look at the individual states. Same deal. Jeff in Chaparral, New Mexico. Hey, Jeff, what's up? Thanks for listening to 1290 AM.
Hey. Thank you. Speakerphone. Thank you, Tom. Great show. I'm just wanted to share what I'm doing with Get Out the Vote.
Okay.
We the people, we don't have the money the Republicans do, but we have people power. And nearly all of us have phones. And I'm calling everybody on my phone, telling them to get out and vote, and asking them to call everybody on their phone. A lot of it's family, friends, acquaintances, business relations.
Yeah, just go through your contact list. Yeah.
Yeah. And if everybody does it who's listening today, that's 5 million people to start with.
Yeah.
And they, you know, multiply that.
Yeah, I'm with you. Jeff, thank you. Good on you. Good on you. Gloria in Lumber Bridge, North Carolina. Hey, Gloria. You wanted to talk about the pot, you know, the dangers of Ebola?
Yes, sir, Mr. Hartman. I wanted to convey the experience I've had in here in North Carolina. You know, North Carolina didn't expand its Medicaid either.
Right.
And
same as Texas.
We've gone through. I live in a county that is one of the poorest in the state. It's in the top 10. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed I myself am disabled, and I do a lot of doctor's appointments and things, and I've noticed how the herds at the hospitals have thinned. It's as if, you know, you go into the emergency room, and which is where people still go. You go into the emergency room, and you get patched up just enough to get you back out of there.
Yep.
And they don't do anything other than that.
Well, this is what they did down in Texas with this Ebola patient. They said, oh, you got a fever. Here's some aspirin. Go on home. Or antibiotics.
Yeah, that's what I think happened in Texas.
Yeah.
That or either the fact the lady, the nurse that was doing triage and didn't know where Liberia was.
Yeah, it may well be.
I should certainly hope that won't be the reason. But that's the dangers of not expanding Medicaid.
Yep.
To the people that really need it. Like I said, I live in one of the poorest counties in the state, and we have a lot of poor people that are sick that are going to emergency rooms, and if the hospitals is just like say patching them up and moving them out, then you are putting other people's lives at risk.
Yes.
And the GOP needs to understand that. And like the gentleman just saw before, I'm doing the same thing. Everybody, every way, form, or fashion, I'm trying to make sure everybody votes.
Yeah, make sure that they're all registered and get them out there. Gloria, thank you. Very, very excellent. An excellent point. Very well said. Ed in Greenville, Texas. Hey, Ed, you wanted to get back to Wendy Davis?
Yeah. Yeah, I watched the debate, and I tell you what, she did tear him up. Anybody with two grains of intelligence could see that, could see the difference, the stark difference between the two. Of course, I realize I'm very partisan. I'm a Democrat and always have been. But One other little thing I mentioned to your to the lady that answered the phone. When I was a kid, I was about 11 years old. I'm an old poot, mind you. I'm 79. So anyway, this goes back to around 1947 or thereabouts. I think that's when Harry Truman vetoed the Taft-Hartley Act.
Yep.
And
three times.
My uncle was a union carpenter, and I remember him and my grandfather talking about politics a little bit. And I remember that my uncle came out and he says, "You know, a damn Republican will light a fire in your front yard while you're out front putting the fire out there in the back stealing everything you got." And boy, I said,
that's Naomi Klein's book, you know, Disaster Capitalism. That's she wrote a book about that.
Yep, exactly. And I've got another little antidote. I've just figured that the GOP, you know, the grand old party, has evolved into the party of greed, opposition, and plutocracy. So
there you go. That's,
let you know that this old Democrat, this I've got to go up to the Democratic Party either this afternoon or tomorrow and talk to the fellow who's in charge. I'm going to offer to drive anybody who wants to go to the polls early or on November. I will drive them if they need transportation, and I'm going to get on the phone.
That's great.
To get this thing straightened up. This state is in a terrible shape.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'll let it go at that, Tom.
Thank you, Ed. Thanks for the call, and good on you. Bill in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Bill, thanks for listening to 950 AM. What's up?
You're welcome. Hi, Tom. Enjoy your show. I've read your books. My comment is, a few moments ago you were making comments about raising taxes on corporations and the wealthy, which would serve to benefit education, perhaps raise Social Security, and a lot of other things. But to my intense frustration, Tom, one comment should always go hand in hand with that, because it's always about money and taxes, in that if we didn't have all these ridiculously horrible corporate wars in the Middle East, Afghanistan, and what have you, we'd have plenty of money for that.
Yeah.
All of this is done by corporations that do not care about the expense of our soldiers' lives.
Yeah, also, you're right. This is when Eisenhower said every battleship represents a theft from the American people. He was right.
Sure. There's a woman that visits there, Afghanistan and what have you, frequently, and she has an organization out of Chicago. I forget the name of it. I apologize. Her name is Kathy Kelly. She had, I went to one of her speaking engagements, and she spoke of a state-of-the-art hospital built in Afghanistan, but it uses more.
Bill, we're out of time. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your thoughts, my thoughts, and the news of the day right after this. Welcome back. James, watching Free Speech TV in Spring City, Tennessee. Hey, James, you want to talk about the Koch brothers?
Yes, sir, Mr. Hartman. How are you today?
I am fine. I hope you are, too.
Great. So, thank you.
So what's up?
That. Well, I've been connecting my dots and what I can put together, the ideology of the Koch brothers. It looks like a direct threat to my very liberties, my freedoms in this country, and to my children's future. This ideology, I clearly connect that dot to the reason why we have the Patriot Act written, the very protection each and every one of us in this country. Their ideology has been undermining this country and has made it very vulnerable.
For example?
And, well, look at what's going on in Texas right now because of this corporate ideology and how it's weakened our health care system to the point that people are shorthanded, they're overworked. They can't even identify something as simple as the connection with the Ebola that
right.
has come into our country.
Right.
And then at this point, I would call on my leaders of my country, President Obama, my governors, the DOD, FBI, and I'd even call on the leaders of the UN and Interpol and demand that this ideology just clearly looks like a form of terrorism to all of humanity.
Well, let,
put to rest.
Yeah, I can see where somebody could build that argument. And I would say that on the other side, you'll find libertarians saying that because the state is the only agency in a country that has the power to use, you know, to kill you, literally. I mean, you know, to guns and jails, the state is the terrorist. This is the stuff that they're peddling. You know, I think that both sides would do well not to use terrorist as an argument. I think that what we're seeing is America being reduced to third world status, because third world status is basically libertarianism. It's the government doesn't do anything. You've got no government sector. Your government sector goes from 20% or 30% of your economy. It's in the neighborhood of 20% here in the U.S. Most European countries is around 30%. In Canada, it's even a little more than that. You're dropping that back down to 4, 5, 6% of the economy. And when you do that, guess what? You become a third world country. Excellent point, though, James. Thank you for the call. Tom in Tucson, Arizona. Just have a minute to the break, Tom. Quick one.
Yes, conservatives are hateful and greedy. They would let you die if it would cost them money to save you.
Well, that's essentially, you know, what Ron Paul said when he was in the presidential debates, when he was asked, you know, what do you do if you got a 30-year-old young man who doesn't have health insurance and he's, you know, laying in the street bleeding out in front of the hospital, you know? Somebody in the audience yelled, "Let him die." And Ron Paul essentially said, "Yeah, you know, it's not my obligation to pay his health insurance bill." This is a classic example, Tom, and you're doing a good job of pointing it out, how it's either a we society or a me society. Now, we used to have a we society, and to some extent, but 34 years of Reaganomics has turned it more and more into a me society. And the me's who are getting it, who are getting all the goodies, are the rich people. Period. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. It is 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Rudy in Riverside, Illinois. Hey, Rudy, how you doing?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. That caller from Texas, he was right on the money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is, I want to tell you about my experience with two infectious staph infections. And I just learned I had one in 2008 and 2010. And I don't think the infectious disease doctors are as knowledgeable as they ought to be. I had two of them. I had to remember where I was when I got those infections.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't identify it the first time. The second time, they identified it as Staphylococcus aureus.
Right.
And so from 2010 until now, since I've seen a new dentist, the infections took place after I had a dental cleaning.
Oh, really?
It turns out from reading from Thomas Fitzpatrick's textbook, Dermatology, that Staphylococcus aureus colonizes the mucous membranes, like your mouth
right. And
your nasal passages.
Right. It's especially easy to detect in the nose, oddly enough.
Yeah. Now, the doctor I have now teaches at Loyola University near Riverside, and she told me she did every precaution she could take when she cleaned my teeth about a month ago, including using an antibiotic mouthwash. But I had to run down and track this infection on my own through this book I have by Thomas Fitzpatrick, the founder of the dermatology specialty.
Yeah.
So I had numerous doctors coming in to look at me. I was in there for 10 days. My whole left side swelled up with fluid. My left leg was as red as a beet. And I was on antibiotics for 24 hours for about 5 days.
Yeah. Rudy, let me
it was no picnic.
I agree, and I understand. Let me cut to the chase on this. Here's something that is not part of the equation that you're putting out. A lot of these
flesh-eating diseases and a lot of these antibiotic-resistant diseases, whether it's Staph aureus or MRSA or whatever it may be, they come out of hugely. They come out of factory farming, where animals are routinely fed antibiotics, and thus these bacteria become antibiotic-resistant. And that's a real serious problem. We need to be completely rethinking agriculture in this country, because this is causing this problem. And you're right. You know, we need better control over infectious disease. And I think that providing having a national healthcare system where you can actually communicate, where doctors can communicate with hospitals and vice versa, dentists can communicate with doctors, having an electronic record system rather than this thing that has made this woman a billionaire, but that I was going off on at the beginning of the hour, is really important stuff. Rudy, thank you for the call. John in Burbank, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Yes, sir. First of all, Tom, thank you for being you. You brought up the reality of factions last week.
Yeah.
And that it was warned about. Was it James Madison or one of the founding fathers?
Yeah, it's a Federalist Number 10. James Madison wrote that.
Yes. And then you also mentioned about the Alaska Permanent Fund.
Yes.
And I got to thinking, why can't we take back what's ours? I mean, our elected officials are not helping us. Why can't we put a ballot initiative in every state that creates a permanent fund?
You arguably could, although only about a little more between a third and a half of the states, I think it's more closer to a third, allow for ballot initiatives. It's mostly the western states because it's the more recent states. As the state governments had been corrupted by what would today be called billionaires, the robber barons during the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, they so corrupted the legislatures that the new states that were coming in, this was the early years of the progressive revolution in the late 19th, early 20th century in the United States, those new states built into their constitution the ability of the people to override their corrupt legislators through ballot initiatives. And that's why you see it more in the western states than in the eastern states, whose constitutions were written back in the 1700s before, you know, the rich had corrupted the country terribly. But, you know, here's the main obstacle to that, John, is that most people, if you ask them what is the commons, don't know what you're talking about. We have a serious deficit of civics education in this country, a serious deficit of good common knowledge database, you know, shared knowledge about what government is, how it works, what the public spaces are, what the private spaces are, what the commons is, why it's called the commons. You know, from Garrett Hardin's arguments, you know, the tragedy of the commons, to Madison and Jefferson's, you know, riffs on the commons. We don't, you know, most Americans don't know, and that's why it's not going to happen, or at least it's not going to happen next week. And that's why we need to be talking about it more, and that's why I went off on the rant about it I did today. John, thank you for the call. It's an excellent one. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hello, Tom?
Yeah.
Oh, hi. How are you doing today?
Great, but I'll get better. How about you, Charles?
Oh, it's getting better every day. I love your show.
Thank you.
I mean, you're the one, you're at least one of the people that keep me going in this world. Okay? Thanks a lot. But my topic today is basically, as Democrats, we hold ourselves, you know, to a higher standard, morally, you know, and as well as, you know, taking care of people, you know, that can't help themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that we slipped on, one thing that we're going to pay the price for, and we're paying the price for it right now, having to go back into Iraq and in the Middle East, is that I don't think that we pursued Bush and Cheney to court like we should have.
Right.
These people, as far as I'm concerned, they broke international laws, you know, and they got away with it. They just walked away with it. I don't know if Democrats are scared to get into such a big fight in this country.
Yes, they are.
You know, well, if we are, then we have no democracy anymore.
Yeah.
We don't have the same country that my parents grew up, you know.
Yeah, I will not disagree with that, Charles. Increasingly, we live in an oligarchy rather than a democracy, or in a constitutional monarchy where the Supreme Court has taken the role of the monarchs and they've handed power over. You know, traditionally, in monarchies, you have the monarch who kind of runs the government, and then you have, which is in this case the Supreme Court, and then they hand power to the lords and ladies, you know, to the second tier, the economic tier. and you find these big manor houses all over Europe for the lords and ladies. That's now the wealthy few in the United States. Excellent point, Charles. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Melissa Chan is on the line with us. Melissa is a correspondent with Al Jazeera America. She previously served as Al Jazeera's English China correspondent for 5 years, English language China correspondent. Al Jazeera America could be seen on the U.S. on Time Warner Cable, Comcast Channel 107, AT&T Channel 1219, DirecTV 347, Dish Channel 215, and Verizon Fios Channel 614. The website is america.aljazeera.com. Melissa, welcome to the program.
Great to be on.
Thanks for joining us. You are very familiar with China, the situation in China, the politics of it, the cultural dimension of it, all of these things. Tell us what's going on in Hong Kong right now.
Well, I think a lot of people have been looking at these protests, and the media is partly to blame. And it's been couched as a political movement. These people are indeed asking for one person, one vote, universal suffrage. They're asking for the resignation of their chief executive right now. But there's also another side to this protest, which is the economic side. It's been a long time coming, especially if you're someone who has been living in Hong Kong or following the events in Hong Kong for a number of years, actually. There is a major housing crisis, for example. So you have a middle class in Hong Kong, very educated, where they have no prospect of being able to afford to buy anything in Hong Kong anymore. And look, culturally, this is a place where people are used to living together, three generations under one roof. But eventually, people want to start their own families, and they're looking at a situation where they have a housing crisis. So that's number one. Number two, the young students that we see, the high schoolers and the college-age students, they also face very bleak prospects when they graduate in terms of employment. So you have these two things also going along with the politics in Hong Kong right now.
So the housing crisis, my understanding of this is that the housing crisis in Hong Kong is the consequence of an explosion in wealth in mainland China, and many of the mainland Chinese are coming to Hong Kong and buying real estate, either to live in or as an investment, and driving up the housing prices in Hong Kong. Do I have that right?
Absolutely, Tom. That's precisely it. And then people living in Hong Kong themselves, they're seeing what, you know, they view as a somewhat of an invasion. I mean, everyone is Chinese, but Hong Kong was, after all, a British colony for about a century. So there is a sense of a different identity where those from mainland China coming in are viewed as slightly different than the locals. And you have that cultural tension as well.
Well, and a lot of the fortunes that were made in mainland China were made in enterprises that were affiliated with the state. And so they're probably more likely to be, shall we say, is loyal the right word, to state ideology as opposed to the more laissez-faire is really the wrong phrase. It's more small-d democratic philosophy that had governed Hong Kong for 100 years or for 99 years.
There are definitely a lot of dynamics going on here. First of all, you have the people from mainland China with the money
purchasing these homes. And a lot of them, as you said, are affiliated. They made their wealth from state-owned enterprises. They are Communist Party members, most of them. And so there's also a view that these people are coming in with corrupt money, buying up these homes, whereas you have these local Hong Kong middle-class people, white-collar workers, working hard in a meritocratic system where they feel like they're not really getting what they should be getting. And then you also have a situation where Hong Kong and China's economies are very closely intertwined, and you have what I would say an upper class or upper middle class group of people in Hong Kong who are benefiting and have benefited from the situation since 1997. And that's what I would call it. They're the silent, I don't want to use the word majority because we just don't have the hard numbers on how many people are sympathetic to the protesters and how many people in Hong Kong aren't. And I think that's one thing also in the news that we've been looking at is we've seen tens of thousands of protesters on the street. It looks like the entire city is out on the street. And the reality is actually no. I would say that roughly, this is unscientific to a certain extent, but just qualitatively, half the people in Hong Kong are sympathetic to the protesters. And the other half, while not against the protesters necessarily, don't think it's a good idea. Right. You do have that upper middle class in Hong Kong that have benefited from the system, have benefited from doing business with China, that are a little less willing to join the protests or be sympathetic to the protesters and their demands.
What are the similarities and the differences between what's happening right now in Hong Kong and what happened in Tiananmen Square back in the 80s?
That's an excellent question. What I would say is that in Hong Kong, again, going back to its history, having been ruled by the British as a colony for better or worse, for better in the sense that the people in Hong Kong have a real respect for the rule of law. There is very, very strong civil society. Those things were missing at Tiananmen in 1989 in terms of civil society. I mean, you certainly had a grassroots movement that built up very quickly, but you also had, I would say, less sophisticated group of protesters in terms of understanding institutions, understanding the law, understanding electoral politics. Hong Kong has that. And in fact, ever since the British handed Hong Kong over to the Chinese in 1997 and they have this one country, two systems, to a limited extent, there is a legislature. There are limited elections. There are political parties. That's something that was non-existent in Tiananmen in 1989.
So where is it more likely that China is going to basically crush this rebellion, as it were, in Hong Kong? Or is it more likely that Hong Kong is going to end up being the tail that wags the dog of China? It's going to produce do you think that the Communist Party in mainland China is saying, hey, you know, maybe we need to make some reforms, even if most of them are cosmetic, we need to make some reforms? Or are they just looking at this as, you know, a flea on an elephant's back that needs to be flicked off or crushed?
I think in the beginning, in the handover period in 1997, there were a lot of people who hoped that Hong Kong would be the tail that wags the dog. And it's a very, very apt description of what people had hoped. At this point, there would be very few people who believe that this is indeed the case. Now, then the second question is what the Chinese would do or what they would ask the Hong Kong government and the Hong Kong police force to do. And certainly, I think it's very telling that we, everyone, the world, all of us are wondering. It says a lot about China that we're all wondering whether it's going to shoot down and kill teenage protesters, first of all. Secondly, though, just in the last hour, for example, there have been developments where it looks like the nominal leaders are going to at least talk with the government. So the tension has been a little bit smoothed out just in the last hour, and we will have to see in the coming days where the talks go and go from there. But it's really hard to say. A lot of people believe that because Hong Kong is still a major, major financial system with a stock exchange, that the Chinese in the end are going to blink. They can't resort to too much violence with this. Some people have said and suggested that perhaps there will be very limited violence that they will try to manage and, and unfortunately hurt enough people, a limited number of people, to scare the other protesters away.
Right, right. It's going to be very, very interesting to keep an eye on this and see how it's going to play out.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Melissa Chan, correspondence with Al Jazeera America, previously served as Al Jazeera's English language China correspondent for 5 years. Al Jazeera America can be seen on the U.S. on Time Warner Cable, Comcast Channel 107, AT&T Channel 1219, DirecTV 347, Dish Channel 215, and Verizon Fios Channel 614. Melissa, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thank you.
Very good talk. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the day right after this, 15 minutes past the hour. Be sure to check out our newly reinvented TomHartman.com. And welcome back. Charles in Conway, South Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. Hey, Charles, what's up? Charles? Charles is listening to his TV, not his phone, or his phone is muted. So let's try Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, you wanted to talk about, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV, you wanted to talk about Ebola?
Yes, and thanks for taking my call, Tom. You know, a lady called earlier from North Carolina talking about being how poor the state is. Mm-hmm. And then you talk about Texas not having the Affordable Care Act. If you look at a map, there really is no health care from Texas to the Virginia state line.
Yeah, it's the old Confederacy.
Yes. Here in Alabama, we don't have the Affordable Care Act. They have been closing hospitals in the rural areas. That some hospitals have just, they're now refusing to deliver babies. Wow. And so women who are in labor have to drive over an hour to a hospital to deliver. But a lot of these in North Carolina, Belhaven, they close the hospitals. There's no place for people with a heart attack to go. You know, you can't even get a helicopter in there fast enough to life flight them.
Yeah, we had a Republican mayor of one of the North Carolina towns on who was all upset that the hospital in his town got shut down because because Pat McCrory and Art Pope refused to expand Medicaid.
Yes, and all over the South, these hospitals are now for-profit hospitals.
Right.
When I went in one day, I had coughed to the point where I felt like I had ripped my diaphragm. Mm. I had to wait in emergency room holding 14 hours for a contract nurse to arrive at the hospital before I could be moved to a floor for care. All of these hospitals are using contract medical personnel, and we have to wait for them to show up. And a lot of times, if you have a nurse working at one hospital, she works a 12-hour shift, then she goes to another hospital and works another 12-hour shift. And if she doesn't, she can be fired from her contract employer. And so I'm wondering if we do have, say, a massive Ebola outbreak epidemic across the South, do you think a contract nurse living in Florida is going to leave her family and come to Montgomery to get isolated in a hospital?
Mm.
These, you know, they're not looking at the long-term effect of not having national health care.
Yeah, this goes back to my comment about that German wealthy businessman who said, I don't want to be a rich man in a poor country.
Well, that's what we've got now.
Yeah, 34 years of Reaganomics has just devastated the middle class to the point where much of America resembles a third world country.
Yeah, well, being on Medicare as a disabled person, I was in the room and my doctor was out of town over the weekend. The person covering for him came in and said, there's nothing wrong for me, send her home. And the IV antibiotic bag wasn't even empty. And he said, take it off and send her home.
Hmm.
Of course, Medicare was already paying for this antibiotic. And it turned out that the bones in my head are hollow and they were full of an infection.
Ew.
And so I wound up having surgery to put holes in there to drain the infection.
Wow.
And this cost more money because if I had had the antibiotic bag, maybe it would have cured it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Well, and stopping antibiotics early sometimes makes those things much worse.
Yes, it does. And this is the only antibiotic I can take. And so to get a half a dose is deadly for me.
Yeah.
And
that's crazy. That's crazy. This is and it's all about, hey, you know, what will they pay? What, you know, it's you're right, Norma. Norma, thank you for the call. And thank you for sharing your story. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Peter in Chowella, Washington. Am I saying that right, Peter?
Yes, you're saying that right.
So you used to live in New Zealand?
Yes. First of all, I want you to know, Tom, that your personal history and life are very inspiring to me.
Thank you.
I read a few of your books and just wanted to let you know you're a great inspiration.
Thank you.
My history is when I graduated from school, I was pretty inspired by the Down Under people, my classmates, and I ended up going to New Zealand to do my private practice, alternative health care provider.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went down there, of course, I didn't know if I could help the New Zealanders or the New Zealanders what we were going to do together, but I was so inspired by the fellow that came on this morning from Germany and his experience, which was mine in the 80s, and this is it. At my income level, I was paying 50 to 55 cents on the dollar in taxes.
Right.
And to most Americans, they fall over with that.
Yeah.
And but I knew where that 50, that money was going. It was going for health care and education, bottom line. Those were the first two priorities, and that was my experience.
Right.
So that was very inspiring to me. It didn't bother me, the 50, 55 cents.
Well, the other thing, Peter, is that as tax rates go up, wages go up, because people, when you're negotiating with an employer, for example, for wages, people are negotiating in terms of after-tax income, not before-tax income. They're thinking about, what am I going to be able to take home? What can I live on? And so it's simple math. I mean, if you look at the history of the United States, what you see is that when tax rates go up on working people, wages go up. And when tax rates go down on working people, and they actually did for a couple of years during the Reagan administration, some of the tax rates went down on working people, then wages fall because the employer knows, hey, this guy's keeping an extra $100 a week out of his paycheck because the taxes went down. So I'm going to cut $100 out of his paycheck because I know he can live on X. And so when you look at countries like New Zealand, that where, as you said, you're paying 55% of, 55 cents on the dollar in taxes on your higher income dollars, that
yes.
people get it that, the wages go up. This is, as I said, the average industrial wage in Germany is $54 an hour. It's certainly not that in the United States. Well, Germans pay higher taxes. Yeah, what do they get for that? Absolutely free college countrywide. Absolutely free health insurance countrywide. One of my very best friends, Gerhard Liefert, one of the guys who helped start and run the Salem International program in Germany, had a heart attack 6 months ago. I was gone from the show for a week because I went over to Germany to hang out with him. And he went into the hospital presenting with just a massive full-blown heart attack. And Gerhard's in his 60s, and he's, they put a couple of stents in, and then they sent him to this rehabilitation center for a month. And this is where I visited him. There's a hotel right next door to it for the visitors. I stayed in the hotel next door. But it's like a hotel. It's like a five-star hotel. And every three times a day, he'd have his blood pressure taken. They counseled him on how to eat well. Gerhard became a vegan as a result of this and lost a bunch of weight. And he's reversing his heart disease. And it's all free. I mean, this is the German healthcare system. They take care of people. In the United States, my brother-in-law had a heart attack. They operated on him, and then they said, "Good luck, see you later." And it's like, anyway, I'm off on a rant here.
Well, yes, you are on the rant. And just to add to that, in my history in the U.S., in my employment background, I was in the workforce when you didn't look for work, you didn't look for a job based on the benefit package, because you got paid enough wage to where you could deal with whatever insurance you needed.
Right.
For example, out of what you got paid.
Or benefits were just kind of the given, because there was enough people, you know, a third of America was unionized before Reagan came into office, which meant that for every union job, there's an identical job with identical pay and benefits that is not union, because the union jobs create the wage floor. So basically two-thirds of America had union incomes and union benefit packages, which is pretty substantial. Yeah. Now you've got 8% unionization, which means 16% of America has union pay and union benefits, which is a big difference from, you know, 65% of America. So, Peter, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing your story. It's a great one. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Public education?
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to link together, you know, I think the basis of why we're in such gridlock in this country is, you know, things like what is going on in Denver, where they really want to dumb down the Denver public school system, because I think that, like, people like Rick Perry and a lot of these very dogmatic people, you know, they're victims of, I guess, an extremely poor education, and they're so dogmatic. That is why, like for instance, in Germany under the Kaiser, I'm sure that similar things happened. You know, Germans don't want to, so that's why they, you know, it's just anathema to say, well, you know, we want to create an elite. They've already been there, and as a result, they weren't able to move from a technically, you know, from hello.
Yeah, no, I'm here.
Yeah, they have not been, they were not able to move into and answer the problems that a democracy full of people who are enlightened and intelligent can do. I mean, we can only move forward if our elected leaders represent people who
I would submit to you, John, that Rick Perry knows what he's doing, and that most of these Republicans know what they're doing. They know that they're there to serve the Koch brothers and the other billionaires in America, and but they're relying on people who you are correct, who are the victims of a health
You're
public.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
They're relying on the voters not knowing what these guys are up to, because they've stripped civics out of our schools. John, thank you for the call. Well said. We'll be back. It's Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman program. Welcome back. And time for our crazy alert for the day.
And now for something completely
crazy.
You so crazy.
You crazy.
This is crazy. This is crazy. This is crazy.
Oh, now you're just being crazy.
So is this crazy or is this not? Shauna Bigelow is over at the Huffington Post. Andy Campbell is writing, is only a little jealous of the numerous sex dolls her boyfriend keeps in the basement. Yep, seriously. Most of the time, though, she and Dave Hockey enjoy fun with the dolls. They spent $32,000 on these sex dolls. Seriously. She says, you know, it's a doll, it's not real. Who has the perfect body? So this is all very strange. But they're trying to point out this couple who have sex with their sex dolls and each other, three ways and stuff like that, that according to them, about 30% of people who have sex dolls are couples. I don't know. I'm skeptical. Anyway, George in Albert Lea, Minnesota. Hey, George, you wanted to disagree with me about health care?
Well, not just healthcare, but I'm just wondering, will I get a chance to make my point this time?
I don't know.
I mean, there's no point in me trying to make my point if you're going to cut me off and filibuster to the next commercial and not let me make my point. You set up a straw man and after you cut me off and argued against the straw.
George, what's your point?
My point is you're talking about absolutely free education, absolutely free healthcare, absolutely free this. Nothing is free. Somebody has paid a price for that.
Okay. Is that your point? That's everything you wanted to say?
Let me provide
you with the frame that I'm viewing this through. We know from our experience with the GI Bill that when we invested roughly $1 trillion in the education of a generation of mostly young men who had fought in World War II, that produced about $7 trillion in additional tax revenue that we wouldn't have had because those young men, because of their college education, had higher earnings than they would have otherwise had. We know from the experience of every developed country in the world that every dollar invested in education, it returns somewhere between $2 and $14 in added tax revenue to the government over the lifespan of the people involved. We know that for a fact. We shouldn't be talking about education as an expense because it is not an expense. It is an investment. And it is insane that we are talking about it as an expense. I would submit to you, George, that it's the same thing with public health. We are losing billions of person hours a year in the United States because people aren't well. The statistics are, the math is irrefutable. You look at the developed countries of the world that have public health care systems, good national health care systems. A, they spend half as much as we do. They spend half as much as we do in France and Germany on health care because there's nobody, you don't have all these companies sucking money out of it. You don't have people like Stephen J. Hemsley, who's taken over $1 billion as the CEO of United Healthcare. You don't have this woman who's running this digital file sharing information for doctors business taking $2 billion. You don't have the parasites and the business people skimming off the top in a national healthcare system, number one. And number two, when people can get and stay healthy and they can catch disease early, it costs all of us less. Because Ronald Reagan championed and signed a law during his presidency that said that if you show up at an emergency room, you even if you have no health insurance, the ER docs have to see you. We have now a system in the United States where people who are sick, you don't go to the, a woman finds a lump in her breast. She doesn't go to the, she can't, and she has no insurance. If she goes to the ER, what are they going to say? They're going to say, come back when it breaks through and you're bleeding. You know, come back when you're dying. This is an emergency room. We deal with emergencies. And so what happens is we have people who have no health insurance. And as a consequence of that, they're waiting until they are dying or until they're really sick. And it's less productivity, less people available to be part of the workforce, and it's far more expensive. It's a stupid way to run the system. So you're right. Somebody is paying the bill, but it's an investment. We're getting a return on that investment. Your turn, George.
So you're admitting then that nothing, I mean, you made it sound like, you know, all these benefits just kind of fall out of the sky by, you know, uniforms just kind of sprinkle them out of the air from the gumdrop palace. Somebody's paying for it.
Of course.
That's my point.
Of course, but no, George.
For everybody that gets something they haven't earned, somebody's earned something they didn't get.
George, if you put $100 into an IRA for your future, is that an expense? Did you just pay $100?
I would consider that an investment.
Exactly. I consider education and healthcare an investment. So when you say somebody has to pay for it, no, somebody has to invest in it. And that somebody is us.
Well,
we the people.
My point is that when you are using somebody else's dollars, you're less careful about whether that's a real investment.
That's demonstrably not true.
Or not.
No, that's demonstrably not true. Oh. If you, George,
really?
Yes.
I mean, you think you spend somebody else's money? Government bureaucrats are going to be just as careful spending money that's not theirs, that they didn't have to work for, that they didn't have to earn by the sweat of their brow, as carefully as the person that actually spent, that earned the money.
As a matter of fact, yes. And the research is in on that, too. And it's quite solid, George.
No, it's
here's how it works. Let me just explain this to you, George. I'll give you an opportunity to rebut me if you would like. Here's how it works. Number one, when you have a government health care system like Medicaid or Medicare, which operate on a 2% or 3% maximum overhead, as opposed to like United Healthcare or these for-profit companies with billionaires running them who are operating on a 20, 25% skim off the top. But when you have a government system like that, there are people whose job is to make sure that the money is being spent appropriately. On the other hand, if it's just you, because you know, hey, you're a libertarian and you don't believe in health insurance or getting anything from the government, and you're having a heart attack, odds are you're not going to call five hospitals and ask them what they charge. In fact, the experience across this country has been that individual consumers very rarely make healthcare choices based on expense. They, other than, I won't get any health care at all. That's very common. People who are uninsured simply don't go in for health insurance or in for health care. But people who have insurance or people who are going to have things, you know, that are not covered by insurance, they're making their decision based on who's the best doctor, who's the nearest doctor, who can see me right now. We don't have the time, and frankly, most of us don't have the sophistication to be shopping for medical services, to be saying, you know, do I want this kind of saline solution or do I want that kind of saline solution? Do I want this antibiotic or that antibiotic? Do I want this surgical procedure or that surgical procedure? Based on what? Where do we get this data? George?
Well, so we're going to hand that.
Have you ever shopped around?
So we're going to hand out this personal responsibility to.
It's not personal responsibility, right? George. It's not personal responsibility.
Okay.
The Koch brothers
so
would like you to believe it is, but it's not personal responsibility.
We're going to hand off this responsibility to experts. Is that what you're saying?
It is not responsibility. It
we're
is.
We're going to have experts decide.
What we know is that when you have.
We have experts?
Yes. When you have healthcare systems.
So how do we know these people are experts?
Because we hired them, George.
Who hired them?
We did. We the people. First three words of the Constitution. Look it up.
Politicians hired these people.
No, politicians vote on laws. They don't hire people.
Okay, well, these laws that these politicians pass, these people get hired by somebody.
Absolutely. For example, the Medicare Administration, the whatever it's called, the Medicare agency that administers Medicare. Yes, they hire these people on behalf of you and me to look at to watch over our tax dollars. So you've got full-time people who actually went to college to learn how to do this stuff, medical actuaries who are overseeing how your money and mine is spent on Medicare. Whereas when you or I decide that, you know, we need medical services right now, hey, I think I'm having a heart attack, we don't have the ability to do that.
But ultimately, that flows back to the politicians that pass the
law. No, it doesn't. It's got nothing to do with the politicians.
Yes, it does. These politicians pass a law that sets up a bureaucracy.
George, you dislike politicians.
Somebody gets hired. Hires people. Well, who hires them?
George, what is the difference between the bureaucracy at Medicare and the bureaucracy at United Healthcare?
Who hires these people? Somebody hires them. They get a paycheck.
What is the difference between the bureaucracy at Medicare and the bureaucracy at United Healthcare? I can tell you.
Where I'm going with it.
No, I want you to think about this. This is important stuff, George. The bureaucracy at Medicare is committed to saving taxpayer dollars and to increasing the level of health in this country, to getting the best health outcomes. Because if you get bad health outcomes, it costs us more. The bureaucracy at United Healthcare is committed to making sure that Stephen J. Hemsley makes a second $1 billion, that the 100 executives who make more than $1 million a year at United Healthcare continue to make their $1 million, and that the stockholders of United Healthcare continue to get their dividends. Those are very different priorities. I'll take Medicare any day. George, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Please feel free to call and try and debate. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Jim, watching Free Speech TV in Norwood, New Jersey on the DirecTV satellite. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was starting to snooze here. Hey, Tom, I wanted to call you and just pass on a little something that was passed on to me from this woman. I saw her at a coffee shop. I was looking out the window. She's parking a car, and she had a bumper sticker, and she walked into the coffee shop, and I said, "I like your bumper sticker." I said, "Not a Republican."
Ah,
anyway,
interesting.
She said something to me that was, like, simple and profound.
Yeah.
And she said, take away the issues, take away the faces and all the hysteria. And it comes down to philosophy. And there are two distinct different philosophies. Now, that was a month or so ago, and I've had discussions trying to bear that in mind. Mm-hmm. And on so many different levels, you know, it really disarms people because, you know what, what philosophy, what does it really look like if everything went your way, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you just take away all the things that come up that make people hysterical, well, say that there wasn't that in the opposition. Say you had everything you wanted. What would it look like?
Right.
And basically, it comes down to two things. You know, democracy, Democrats, rather, it's the protection of the commons.
And the working
people. Republicans, it's a three-legged stool. It just seems to me, and I'd like to just shoot this out to you for you to expound on. But, you know, it's a three-legged stool. With, you know, lower taxes, smaller government, less regulations. Right. You know, and that Ayn Rand kind of...
Right, and so turn the United States into Liberia.
Right. That's just it. Like, listen, you know, like if you cut through all of this hysteria, because I just talked to my friend's mother-in-law, you know, a wife of this minister, and this woman, I just got this blast. It sounded like listening to Rush Limbaugh. You could practically listen to it. You can hear where they got the information from.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just this blast of, like, nonsense and this, like, vitriol. And it's like, whoa, you know?
Yeah, I know. I just had it happen about 5 minutes ago, 3 minutes ago.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I tell you what, you know, that's a pretty good example. I mean, like, well, go ahead, Mr. Explain to me what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
You know, what
yeah.
what is it going to look like when your neighbor over here is like, you know, well, somebody gets sick and,
we will become the People's Republic or the Libertarian Republic of Liberia. I mean, the Libertarian Paradise of Liberia. This is, you know, if the government doesn't involve itself in health care, then, hey, you know, you're not prepared for a public health epidemic. If the government doesn't provide education, you get people who are not educated. And so they don't understand. Maybe they can't even read. They don't understand when you know, people say, here's what Ebola is. Here's how it works. Here's what you should and shouldn't do. And they end up breaking out of, you know, Ebola clinics or breaking into them. And you know, I mean, it's just, people go, how can people be so dumb? Well, you've got a country where, you know, education has been privatized as well as health care. You've got oligarchs in Liberia. There's some very wealthy people in Liberia. And they live in, you know, gated compounds, and they have their very own little, you know, life. And that's the, you know, it's the libertarian paradise. Jim, thanks for the call. Yeah, what a great bumper sticker. Not a Republican. Love it. We'll be back. Ten minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Gene in the town where our oldest child was born, Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Gene, what's up?
I'm fine. I just wanted to let you know that the people of Detroit pretty much have lost the AFSCME pensioners have lost half of their pensions, and that the water department, Judge Rhodes, decided that the people don't have a right to water.
Right, because they're privatizing it, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yep. Welcome to the libertarian paradise of Detroit. It's this,
correct.
You know, Rick Scott, or not Rick Scott, Scott, Rick Snyder. Just so many Ricks and so many Scotts. Okay. Anyhow, it's Rick Snyder in Michigan, and his libertarian band have just totally ruined the state that I was born and grew up in. It's pretty horrific. Gene, thank you for sharing that story. Jim in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on. First of all, I want to say thanks for having one of the best intellectual, logical, and factual shows on talk radio.
Thank you.
I've had graduate courses in economics, and something strikes me, and I've pointed out to my right-wing friends, and they just kind of have a glazed look on their face. When tax rates are higher, one of the items that is tax-deductible is the items of production, land, labor, and capital, right? Labor being one of them.
Right.
So it would seem to me that when taxes are higher, you want to reduce your tax burden And the way, one of the ways you do that is you increase the number of jobs or what you pay your wages.
That's correct. And that's why, that's why during the era from the 1940s until the 1980s, when corporations paid a third of the federal government's budget and corporate income taxes were actually paid, during that period, wages were quite high in the United States, wages for average working people. And that's why since Reagan cut corporate wages and they've stayed low, now it's now they're paying between 9 and 11% of the total federal budget, and you and I are making up the rest. These corporations have little incentive to pay good wages because they don't need deductions. They've got all they need.
Yeah, I mean, it's common logical sense that if you want to increase the number of jobs, increase taxes, therefore they have a more incentive to spend more on labor.
That's right. And other and anything else that's deductible, this is where, you know, people think that tax policy is written to raise money. Tax policy is written to encourage or discourage behavior, whether it's at the individual level. We want to encourage people to own a house, so we make, you know, mortgage interest deductible, but we don't make rent deductible, whether it's, to, you know, whatever it may be, to have children, so we're going to give people tax credit for having kids. At the individual level or at the corporate level, we want to encourage people to, you know, fill in the blank, research and development. We want to encourage them to develop new products, so we give them a tax break for that, for doing that. And, you know, there's a lot of things that are tax deductible that, in my opinion, shouldn't be, and other things that probably should be. But this is, you know, it's been a long time since we've gone in and looked at these things in any meaningful way, and we really do need comprehensive tax reform, just not you know, not the way that the Republicans are thinking about it, which means, you know, more tax cuts for the Koch brothers and the other billionaires. Jim, excellent point. Thank you for calling and making it. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
So, Tom, your caller, George, he just bit right down on the Milton Friedman lie.
I know.
That individuals spend other people's money more carelessly and recklessly than they will spend their own. That is a falsity that has been disproven, I'm aware of, by a MIT professor, Dan Ariely, has written recently some books called Predictably Irrational, in which these kinds of lies are demonstrated as false. If you have money, you are the author of the change it brings, no pun intended. And so you will use that power in a way that helps you, right?
Right.
In other words, if you say, Paul, go out and buy us lunch, that's me and you, right?
Right.
I'm going to go out and buy the best thing I can find for you and me to eat for lunch. If you say, Paul, go buy me some lunch, there's no motivation for me to go and buy you something lousy, right?
Right.
None at all. And so, I mean, this is just a big lie. This is a Milton Friedman postulate that the conservatives love. And this is, goes to my point that I was going to bring up, is that they love to redefine. They don't want to get rid of civics in the schools, Tom. They want to redefine civics.
Oh, this is the battle that's going on in Colorado, where you had a bunch of right-wing Tea Partiers elected to a school board. They took over the school board, and then they said, let's change the curriculum and take all that stuff about revolution out. You know, no more efforts to free the slaves, no more efforts to get women the vote, no more efforts to unionize. Really not even so much American Revolution. Let's take all that out and give a patriotic curriculum that encourages people to be good citizens and do exactly what they're told. It's like the Communist Party.
What would they call the Boston Tea Party? Is that civil disobedience?
It was worse than civil disobedience. It was a million-dollar act of vandalism in today's dollars.
And they dressed up as Native Americans. It was a cowardly act. I mean, really. But you think about it. See, they believe in the doctrine of legal positivism, which means that whatever the laws are, first of all, we want to make the laws, and you are obligated to follow them. But when there are laws they don't like, they are morally obligated not to follow them. Actually, William Rehnquist was one who believed in this doctrine of legal positivism. He said that Rosa Parks should never have refused to sit in the back of the bus. He also said that Plessy v. Ferguson should have never been overturned in 1954 with Brown versus Board of Education.
Right.
This is what they believe.
Yeah, yeah, and you're right, Paul. And it's a tough and bizarre ideology, for lack of a better word. This whole Republican libertarian ideology. It's just bizarre. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Here we go. It's the end of the show. Once again, holy cow. So fast they spin by. Thanks so much for being with us and helping you win the water cooler wars, hopefully. And don't forget, there's an election coming up in a little over a month, and it's a big deal. You need to let your friends know. You need to let your contacts know. Please make sure you're registered to vote. Please be ready to vote. It's a very consequential election. Democracy does not stand alone. It requires all of us. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.